So, without further ado, thank you guys for coming out. Thank you guys for coming to this reading. Now, and as I said briefly in the write-up on this, is that the story did come out quite a few years ago. I think it was 2006. But I'm still kind of... The reason why I'm choosing to read it here is I'm still kind of proud of the relevance. You know, without spoilers, there's a political angle to it. This isn't a political story, but there's a social angle to it, which I think is still relevant. And then, of course... You know, I was thinking about reading the story and watching, looking at pictures of the East Coast, you know, underwater from Hurricane Irene. So it just felt the story continues to feel relevant for me. So that's why I'm glad to read this one. All right, without further ado, Bodies in the Water by me, Jack Mangan. First, Charlie looked to the dome heavens above, watching twilight deepen across the rain-soaked surface of the only sky he'd ever known. Torrential downpour cascaded the exterior, punctuated by streaks of lightning seeking the dome's attractor poles. The barrier continued to hold against the precipitation, but Charlie's clothes were still damp on his skin. Nothing in this world was dry. Raft people were out of the transit tunnel, Uncle Luther said, grinning broadly. Welcome to Dome Delta's southern sector. I had no idea the rich folks had all this down here, Aunt Gwendolyn gasped. Old man leaned over the raft's edge to let his palm glide across the rippling surface. Water in this sector is only a couple of feet deep, he said. Unmanned mechanical devices were hard at work on the streets around them, manipulating soil to create trenches and dams to control the incessant flow. The rumble of machinery was pervasive, pumps working furiously to keep the water levels manageable. The flood depths were indeed lower by meters here than any place they'd passed in the dome's northern and central sectors, low enough that Charlie could actually see through to the ground beneath. Everything in the southern sector seemed better. The air smelled so clean and healthy that he realized for the first time how noxious the upper sectors had become. Fewer sunken vehicles littered the streets, and those they saw were still poking their tops above water. Most of the buildings appeared to be reparable, as opposed to the swamped, ruined structures of the upper two sectors. The most significant difference of all, though, was the utter lack of bodies in the water. Charlie scanned the river surface all around the raft, silently criticizing himself for his morbidity, but was relieved to see no human remains amongst the floating debris. Likewise, the scaffolding along the dome ceiling was utterly devoid of suicidal climbers bent on jumping to their deaths. Now you see how the other half lives, Charlie's father said, spitting into the raft's wake waters. Just pray that the Ratten family haven't left yet, said the old man, and that no one else from the north sectors knows about they plane. He'd lived in one of the upper floors apartments back in the north sector tenement building, but Charlie had never known his real name. Our escape from this damned flooded planet depends on them crazy aristocrats. Charlie's mother scowled, speaking softly so as not to wake his younger sister, Leah. Sitting in their big house, waiting for the dome to fill up like a giant fishbowl, watching their neighbors all flying away. Maybe they love their home and don't want to leave, even if it means drowning in the flood, Aunt Gwendolyn said. Luther shook his head. I know the Raritans. That's not their style. I don't know why they're still here, why they've waited so long to escape Magnetite's terraforming disaster, but I can assure you they won't sit idly and die in their estate. Don't matter much to me what the Raritan family do, old man said. Seven of us leaving in the Raritan's private ship, with or without them. That's all I know. If we don't get off this planet, we're dead, Charlie murmured, glancing upward at the streaked dome sky. That space plane is our last hope. After a brief drifting rest, Charlie's father submerged the shaft of the float's lone pole and went back to his struggle with the current. Luther, you're going to have to direct us from here. My pleasure, Bob, Luther said. He grinned at Charlie. I used to work with all of the mining bosses down in this sector, you see. But more importantly, Charlie's mother said, and more helpful to us, Luther kissed enough ass in his days as go-between for the miners and bosses that he'd been to some of their home offices, including the one at Mr. Raritan's house. Luther shot her a frown, then said, Yes, I even have a high security clearance as an honored guest at the Raritan's state property. Fancy high clearance won't mean shit if they don't show up on time, she sneered. Second part. Charlie woke to the next morning's sunlight, which had struggled first through Magnetite's cloud cover, then through the dome shell and internal atmosphere to touch gently upon his eyelids. He remained lying still in the early morning's chilly peace, watching the waking sunlight bring the flooded southern suburbs to life. There were no buildings of commerce or industry around them at all anymore, just grand houses and tall vegetation marking the borders of lush estates. Won't be long now, Luther said, just a few blocks away. Lord, I hope that plane is still there, muttered old man, almost to himself. The artery which bore them forward seemed to be growing steadily more congested with empty, discarded vessels. Abandoned boats, canoes, and jury-rigged flotations clogged the lush, hedge- and brick-lined streets. Old Man moved up front to mutter curses and shove the small boats out of their way. Charlie's father was forced to steer the raft around a large, free-drifting yacht while two crane robots worked to secure it to a makeshift dock. As the crane's engines faded behind them, Charlie noticed a new sound, a faint susurrus of a distant crowd. It grew louder as they drifted further down the submerged suburban avenue. All seven on the raft listened in uneasy silence until finally Luther cleared his throat. "We've reached the Raritan's address." The raft soon floated before a pair of tall, extravagant metal gates. A pair of android guards stood ankle-deep on either side. Countless watercraft were strewn untidily around the gleaming entranceway, lined up along the high, ivied brick walls to the left and to the right. There could be no mistake. A sizable crowd busily chatted to itself beyond these walls. Said Charlie's mother, "Seems we ain't the only ones heard about that space plane." Luther called out, "Greetings, android guard, sir. Your sensors will undoubtedly detect my high guest security clearance at the Raritan Estate." "No boats inside," one of them said, its deep voice designed to instill compliance and fear. Human in all appearances, save facial expression, the guards maintained their poker faces and swung the double gates inward between flanking columns of marble. The seven disembarked and set their raft drifting and colliding into the driftwood parking lot. Even though he was trudging through water above his knees, Charlie felt numbly delighted to walk again. It had been a long, long, slow ride through the upper two sectors. The driveway beyond the gates sloped gently upward, soon outrunning the waning flood tide. Their feet trod from small splashes to mud to firm wet gravel. As the cold water dripped away from their clothes, so did their despair. Old Man whistled cheerfully. Charlie noticed that even his mother wore a half-smile. The voices of the crowd grew steadily louder as they walked, though trading them back their anxiety in exchange for their short-lived merriment. "Where is everybody?" Leah asked, frowning from her perch atop her father's shoulders. Her vantage was still too low to see over the high, densely grown, well-groomed hedges that enclosed their winding path. No one answered her. The driveway turned one final bend and opened up into an expansive, lavishly decorated courtyard. An enormous two-story mansion sprawled for what seemed like miles into the distance. A podium had been erected on a covered patio to their left, adjacent to the house, just visible from the edge of the driveway. Charlie couldn't believe how many Northerners were crowded on the lawn before the stage. He wondered if his group looked as ragged and tired as the lot of them. The refugees stood or sat in orderly, sectioned rows, talking amongst themselves, watching the platform with nervous anticipation. "Maybe the Raritans have enough ships to carry all of us," Aunt Gwendolyn said, frowning. The yards all about them were thick with trios of the android guards. The nearest of these triads approached them, their eyes fixated upon Luther. "You have a security clearance here, do you not?" one of them rumbled. Luther nodded. "I acted as liaison between the miners and Mr. Raritan and his executive colleagues on multiple occasions. I..." "Move along to the side of the house. Mr. Raritan is about to speak. The order enforcement officers there will direct you further." The android's facial expressions indicated that the conversation had closed. Luther snapped his jaw shut and followed the rest as they shuffled off in the direction they'd been commanded. Charlie was taken by the glamour of the place. Gold and bronze trim on every artificial structure on the property. Every natural flower and vegetation growth conformed to the meticulous grooming of agricultural machines. Charlie was astounded to see a thin biped robot spraying water over a patch of white orchids. Such a sight was incredible after he'd just spent 4 days trying to escape two drowning sectors, surrounded by water, water everywhere. A wire fence had been constructed between the house's front yard and the massive lawn where the speech was to be given. More trios of androids were situated along its rim. A few of these groups watched them walk up toward one of the narrow openings in the wire. A threesome also stood guard at this break in the fence. One of them spoke. "Children to the seats in front, adults go all the way to the back." Charlie's mother reacted badly to this order, shouting shrilly at the androids, who were unmoved. Gwendolyn attempted to console her while Charlie's father let Leah down from his shoulders. He led her to Charlie and stuck her smaller hand in his. "Keep your sister safe until we can meet up again," Charlie's father said, fixing Charlie's eye with his own. "And keep yourself safe too, son. Whatever happens, your mom and I will find you again in a little while. Don't worry." Charlie nodded and his father hugged him. Comprehension began to dawn for Lear as her father kissed her forehead, and she and Charlie began to walk in the opposite direction as the adults. She cried and protested fiercely, trying to wriggle away, but Charlie said nothing to scold her, just tightening his grip on her little hand. Their mother's wails could still be heard behind them. He felt his own tears brimming, but fought them, even as they streamed unabashedly down Leah's face. Brother and sister walked along the cleared space just outside the assembled crowd, trying to avoid the sometimes hostile stares of the adults massed to their left. Finally, they descended the gently sloping path in the grass to the rows of seats up front, all occupied by children, ages ranging from as young as Leah to a few years older than Charlie. Most, but not all, of the children were sitting somewhat calmly in their chairs. The brother and sister walked down just in time to see an android guard forcefully lead two disruptive boys away from their front row seats. Charlie picked Leah up by her waist and hurried to claim the two newly empty spaces. Third section. Charlie didn't even have enough time to become impatient before an old man appeared on the stage, walking out through its black curtain and up to the podium with his arms raised. He was greeted with no applause, merely the hushing of conversations. The man seemed to direct a smile largely at the front rows of seats. Charlie had never seen anyone dressed this way. Everyone he'd ever known had worn simple clothes for work or leisure. The man on stage wore a suit that was a darker gray than his hair and beard, with a white shirt and glittering red tie at the center. The points of his gunmetal mustache grew more pronounced with his grin, which was simultaneously endearing and unnerving. "Welcome, you tired, poor, wretched masses. Lend me your ears. I..." The man paused and swept the beam of his smile across the entire congregation of listeners. "I'm Emerson Nathan Raritan, and this is my family." He gestured grandly toward the maroon curtains to which he'd come, and five children shuffled out, their ages ranging from as young as Leah to a few years older than Charlie. All of their expressions and outfits were a bleak gray. Mrs. Raritan came last, a stark visage of black and white. The six Raritans lined up behind their patriarch at the microphone stand. The ringleader's smile still on his face, he began to speak again. "I've a lot to say, my northerner friends. Mostly matter, but with some art. In other words, most of it's important. Now listen. It has rained upon planet Magnetite for many months now, but I have chosen this occasion to speak, because it is precisely 40 days and 40 nights now since the new Massip waters overran the dam and flooded Dome Delta's valley. It is with this number in mind that I have taken it upon myself to play Noah's role and shuttle all the animals to safety in my family's private ship, my Ark, so to speak. We will leave tonight and let Magnetite have her world back. She has certainly made it clear that we are no longer welcome here." Raritan's voice echoed across the attentive audience. "But of course I have only one ship. And look at all of you out there. I could never accommodate such a large number of people on my journey away from Magnetite. Do you find this quite a dilemma?" He laughed, shaking his head. No one in the audience made a sound. "Well, I, for one, do not. I have planned for this eventuality ever since the new Massip first broke Delta's northernmost wall, entering and violating the sanctity of our dome. Just this morning, I made contact with some of my people across the solar system." He paused, clearly enjoying the small outbreaks of conversation throughout the audience. "Yes, off-world contact. The southern comm centers went down, just like the ones up north. But therein lies the difference between our two worlds. Where there's money, anything can be fixed. Well, except the poor, of course. You see, Corporate Ore, our mining company and employer, has decided that it wishes to waste no more money on this untamable planet. So they intend to write it off as a loss and leave all non-essential equipment down to drown in its wild rivers. That includes you, my friends. The bottom line is that this solution to the Magnetite problem is more cost-effective than continuing to fight her atmosphere, and much cheaper than sending out a bunch of ships to rescue you all." Charlie could hear some of the adults in the sections behind him beginning to stir. The children were also getting restless. Raritan recognized this. He cleared his throat and adopted a more businesslike posture at the podium. "But fear not, my friends. Though you have been abandoned on this planet, your legacies will not perish with you. I have a solution to the problem of the limited passenger room aboard my spacefaring vessel. When my family and I depart Magnetite aboard our personal ship, we will be taking your children away with us, so that they may live on into whatever futures they choose for themselves. The ship is prepared for takeoff even now. It merely waits for my fingerprints on the main console to trigger the ignition." This statement was answered by a chorus of shouts, mostly angry, from the adult sections. Charlie felt as if he'd been struck in the chest. Leah and most of the younger children hadn't yet grasped Raritan's meaning, but a myriad of reactions could be seen in the young teenagers. Some wept, a few cheered, but the majority seemed to be sitting in stunned silence like Charlie, waiting for this man to give further details. Individual shouts could be discerned amidst the rancorous eruptions from the adults. "You can't separate adults from their kids. You gotta take some of us with you, too. It ain't fair. It ain't right. I'm coming on that goddamn ship. You just try and stop me." Raritan raised his arms for quiet, and Android Guard Trio strolled through the crowd, crossing from one side to the other, to enforce calm. His amplified voice then strode out across the lawn as he pointed to a girl seated near Charlie. "I'm sorry, young lady. Could you repeat your question?" Charlie could barely hear her shout over the persisting din from the adults. The girl stood and called out again. "Ah, where will I be taking the children?" Raritan appeared pleased to have been asked the question. "The majority of my off-world correspondence has been with former Senator Andrew Roderick Usher of the planet Opulence, forging a business relationship. Mr. Usher and I have been bidding upon a new luxury dome for wealthy vacationers, situated on a well-terraformed planet, Pliss. The children will come with me there so that they can be used as our labor force. Which is more good news for you, incidentally, because the children would not only escape this death trap with me, but they'd already have employment at their new destination. That is, of course, if Mr. Usher and I win our bid. What was that, sir?" Raritan paused to listen to a shouted question. "Oh, well, of course, the rest of you be welcome to occupy the southern hotels here, until the waters rise, of course." The uproarious response was apparently not the one he'd expected. "My mother was a saint! How dare you hurl insults at me and my family, when I have made the philanthropic decision to rescue your children from death? You're all adults. You've had ample time in your lives to acquire enough wealth to own your own spaceships, like I inherited mine. Nevertheless, your children do not share your guilt for your state of poverty. They have not yet been given the opportunity to choose between prosperity and destitution. But you, self-centered ignorance, would place yourselves and my escaped spacecraft ahead of their innocent young lives, when you yourselves have done nothing to earn that privilege? I hope that your children here will not make the same mistakes that their parents have, to grow up into poor, selfish, ignorant primitives. Your actions only illustrate the differences in character between you all and myself, the reasons why you lived in the slums of the North while I lived here in the respectable South. I will now transport your children to safety and take my leave. But you may take comfort in this, savages. When Prospero left his island, Caliban was its master. Such will be the case here. Once I'm gone, you'll be the lords of Magnetite. You can live here like proletariat royalty until you all drown." The androids now had to wrangle away more than a few angry protesters from the adult crowd. An undercurrent of seething, repressed violence permeated the lawn's atmosphere, kept in check only by the presence of the hulking armed enforcement officers. A pair of these android guards appeared now at the end of Charlie's row of seats, beckoning with their hands for the children to come. The cold ball of anger Charlie had felt in his chest seemed to crack, letting forth the hot fury at its core. The other children shuffled toward the guards, but he stood up on his chair. "Hey!" he shouted at the podium. "Hey!" One of the android guards stalked over and seized Charlie's wrist in its massive hand. But Raritan returned to speak into the microphone. "Hold," he said to the android, and it released its grip. "Do you have something you wish to say, young one?" The abrupt surge of quiet throughout the yard suddenly struck Charlie, and his stage fright threatened to paralyze. He looked at Raritan's expectant, irritated expression and forced himself to speak. "Mister, you can't talk to us like that. Just because you have money, just because you were born in the southern sector, you think that makes you better than any of us? Don't forget Bastille Day." Raritan played exaggerated astonishment. "One of you has actually heard of the French Revolution. I'm amazed. And a child, no less. But don't waste your time or mine with lectures on social class relations, boy. You'll bore me. Count yourself lucky that you get to escape Magnetite. As for Bastille Day, those French aristocrats got what they deserved. Rest assured that such a revolt against the wealthy will never succeed again. We're better protected now, and we own all the guillotines." The commotion in the adult section continued to build, with the androids moving through their ranks, forcefully ushering the people toward the exit. Pockets of resistance were met here and there, but in each of these instances, the dispersed enforcement officers swarmed to the trouble spot and stamped it out. Charlie felt his face getting hot as he stood on his seat. Leo was nervous and tugging on his pants leg. The hulking form of the guard stood less than a meter away. Traces of tears and sweat mingling on his cheeks, Charlie shouted, his voice again carrying throughout the yard. "You talk brave because you have all those androids. If it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be so high and mighty." The crowd of adults roared now in agreement. Raritan sighed disgustedly, nodding an unspoken order to the android on Charlie's aisle. Charlie continued to shout from his chair as the massive synthetic humanoid swooped in and picked him up by his waist. He cried out and pounded his small fists on the thing's back. The northerner adults watched in outrage as the cyber-organic enforcer roughly carried him out of the audience area. The sight of little Leah running behind, crying and punching at its knees, only added to their fury. Within seconds, the crowd's aggressive resistance doubled in intensity. Where there had been groups of two or three northerners facing off against larger numbers of guards, there were now equal numbers of opponents. The android's counter-brutality only gathered more sympathetic muscle to the resistors, and soon enough, Angry humans outnumbered their organic machines in skirmishes all over the yard. The air was thick with taunts and shouts of rebellion. The guards' cavalier shock baton attacks drove the insurgents into a state of frenzy. The violent unrest continued to escalate, approaching the utter abandon of a riot. With viral fervor, a single word began to emanate from everywhere across the lawn, repeated by a myriad of human voices. Charlie couldn't discern whether they were shouting blood, or flood, or even mud. Each answering call escalated volume and ire and desperation. A group of men and women, strangers all of them, suddenly broke from the fray and charged down the hill, screaming their word, rushing directly at Charlie and his captor. The android guard moved too slowly to set him down. The rioters were upon it before it had time to stand upright again. Leah screamed in a new kind of fear, cowering into Charlie's arms as this humanoid thing was overrun and torn to bloody pieces before her eyes. More emboldened northerners charged downhill toward the mesh fence between audience and podium, pilfering melee weapons from falling androids as they ran. Charlie saw Mr. and Mrs. Raritan moving hastily now, trying to shuffle their children off stage through the rear curtains. He saw with grim satisfaction that the crazed insurgents were moving too swiftly. The Raritans would not get away in time. In seconds, the dividing fence was scaled, and northerners were ascending the stage. Charlie remained crouched on the ground by the rows of seats, sitting in a shielding position over Leah, who was still screaming in his arms. Most of the human versus android fighting was happening further up the hill, but some of the struggle had moved down into the lower sections, near where they huddled. He tried to crane his head up to follow the action on stage, but the area had quickly become too choked with people for him to see anything clearly. A sadistic cheer soon erupted near the podium, and he could see a bloody hand being raised above the throng. To Charlie's horror, he realized that the hand was connected to a red-stained forearm that was connected to nothing. It had been rip-amputated. The extravagant rings and the manicured fingers clearly identified the arm's former owner. "Now they can use Mr. Raritan's fingerprints to launch the ship," Charlie muttered to Leah. "They don't even need the rest of his body to be there." A second later, he felt a strong hand grip his shoulder and haul him upward, prying him away from Leah. He rolled and stood up, ready to fight the android for his sister, but was shocked to see that it had been his mother, not one of the guards, who'd thrown him so forcefully. She scooped Leah up and slapped Charlie's face hard. "You stupid boy, look what you've caused," she screamed. "Your sister's not going to get away now because of your mouth." She turned and ran off with the little girl in her arms, leaving Charlie sitting on the ground in the middle of the riot, his face reddened and stinging. A ferocious clash between northerners and guards broke out dangerously close by, but he remained sitting dejectedly, right where he'd been left. Tears gushed down his face as he watched the scenes of horror playing out all around him. He sat utterly still amidst the violence chaos, letting go completely, giving up any active role in his own fate, allowing it to come to him in whatever guise it would. He couldn't shake the feeling that he'd been betrayed by everything he'd ever trusted. At some point during the hostilities, there arose a great rumbling sound in the near distance, which even vibrated the ground where he sat. The intensity of the lawn's battles dipped slightly as the distracted combatants looked up to watch the Raritan spaceship climbing upwards, away from the property. Panicked shouts rang out from the humans still on the ground. "They took the ship! They leave him without us!" Charlie spotted Old Man from his raft in the nearby fracas, blood and fury painted across his enraged features. He cried out to Charlie, "The Raritans is all dead! Those sons of bitches getting away are northerners!" "Yes," Charlie called back, though he didn't rise from where he sat on the grass. "They stormed the stage and stole Raritan's hand. Must have found the ship and used his handprint to make it launch." "Betrayed," Old Man bellowed. "Betrayed by our own people." A fierce brawl erupted further up the lawn, a shapeless mass of thrashing arms and shock batons. The old man gritted his teeth and charged up toward that fight, quickly disappearing from sight. Charlie let his eyes drift upward to follow the space plane as it approached the dome ceiling. The dome's massive exit door slid open and the savage rains poured in, quickly saturating the entire lawn area. The Raritan's commandeered ship, filled with a small group of opportunistic northerners, piloted itself toward the opening in the sky, reaching it, and passed through as Charlie watched from the ground. Its trail of fiery exhaust disappeared minutes after escaping the translucent bubble. The massive section of dome slid shut behind the departing spacecraft. Charlie's gaze dropped back to his surroundings, to the scenes of human and android bloodshed and death. A VTOL transport swooped in to deploy a battalion of fresh androids. The enforcement officers leapt out of the aircraft, firing projectile weapons and tear gas canisters in every direction. Charlie immediately found himself enveloped in a cloud of white smoke. The rest of the morning was a blur. Fourth section. At some point, he reachieved waking consciousness, stirred back to himself by Aunt Gwendolyn's gentle shaking. He sat up and she hugged him closely. The quiet field around their embrace was strewn with human and android bodies alike. He felt the vibration of her sobs as he rested his head against her shoulder. Finally, he summoned the courage to ask the questions he feared to have answered. "Where is everyone else from our raft?" Gwendolyn released him and took a step back. Her face still contorted in a mask of tearful sorrow, she took his hand and led him up the gentle slope of the yard. She said nothing as she walked. Charlie's eyes moved across all of the riot's aftermath, taking in the wonders, the terrors, the joys, the grief of victory in battle. Amongst the stillness, the scattered chairs, the torn patches of grass were small gatherings of mourning, stooping over the gravely wounded or those already perished. None of the dead or their entourages looked any more familiar than the next, and Charlie allowed himself some relief. Still, none of his party were anywhere in sight, and Aunt Gwendolyn's open sorrow dissuaded him from pursuing her with any queries. The two climbed the grassy slope in silence. As they drew nearer to the subtle hill crest, he saw Luther's familiar form standing at the top with his back to Charlie and Gwendolyn. The sound of low weeping from just beyond began to grow more audible as they approached. Charlie recognized his sister's sobs, but was surprised and alarmed by their restraint. Her crying was never so subdued, never so quiet. He ran the rest of the distance to push past Luther. His mother lay dead on her back in the grass, a huge bloodstain painting the entire right side of her blouse. Leah was sprawled across her mother's torso with her face buried in the breast, her little body racked with sobs. Charlie's father crouched on one knee, gently rubbing his daughter's back. He looked up. "You mourn for your mother, Charlie," he said. "You cry for her, goddammit." Charlie staggered forward numbly, and his facade fell to pieces. He slumped down on the grass by her side and let the tears come. Very few words passed back and forth during the night, but Charlie learned that Old Man had also died in the fighting. It turned out his name had also been Charlie, Charles Washing. "Luther had shielded us from the androids during the riot with his security clearance," Gwendolyn explained to Charlie while they sat with the hundreds of other survivors around that evening's bonfire. "The terrible fighting had gotten those things awful bloodthirsty, but even so, they couldn't go against their programming and attack a guest with security clearance, unless they got a direct order from one of the Raritans to do so. And that certainly wasn't going to happen. So we was all safe as long as we stayed near Luther. But that's the problem. Your mother and old Charles both got their blood up and ran out into the fray. First, your mama came back with Leah in her arms, not answering any questions about where you were. Then she took off again into the middle of the riot. I saw them both fighting hard against the androids, but in the end, we found them like that. None of us saw them fall, thank God, just found their bodies after all the killing died down. The next day, a grave had been excavated in the yard right where she'd lain, and the funeral and burial were performed. Words of fond remembrance came forth during the funeral services from Aunt Gwendolyn, from his father, from Luther, and from a dozen people Charlie had never seen before. Once Charlie's mother's body had been let down and the tears and words had come to a pause, the abridged group from the raft walked directly from her funeral to stand at Charles Washing's. Once that was over, the broken group drifted into a circle. Everyone exchanged uncomfortable glances, until finally Gwendolyn spoke up. "Now what?" Charlie wasn't sure what he felt, what he was supposed to be feeling. Everyone had left him alone on this busy day of cleaning and funerals and subdued celebrations. He'd felt grateful for the space, but utterly fearful of his emotional void. "Now we're Southerners," Luther replied. "We'll live the good life here in the South for as long as we can, until the floodwaters rise and take us away. My security clearance should be able to get us into all the Raritan property's food storage areas, and whatever machine servants remain should obey my commands. We'll have all we need to survive before the waters conquer the southern sector. I have no intention of settling here and waiting for the floods to drown me," Charlie spoke up, surprising even himself. "Raritan said he could contact anyone from the southern comm centers. We need to find these terminals and activate them. Call for help. Maybe someone will come and rescue us." Gwendolyn seemed to draw inspiration from Charlie's idea, but then Charlie's father spoke up, not bothering to conceal his bitterness. "Who? Who will we call? Certainly not corporate ore, not after what Raritan said. They'd probably send ships here full of troops to kill us all, rather than risk the bad publicity of the truth we'd tell." "It's true, we can't call corporate ore. And we don't really know anyone else except for poor relatives on other planets who can't afford spaceships of their own." Luther shook his head. "No, there's someone who will help us," Charlie said. Uncle Luther, will you help me search for the Southern Communications Terminals? Epilogue. It took 10 days, but Charlie finally managed to contact Andrew Roderick Usher himself, using the Raritan Estates Communications Terminals. The former senator was reluctant at first to pay to send enough rescue ships for all the stranded northern refugees. But Charlie reminded Usher that his bid for Bliss was still under review, and that the transcript of their conversation could easily be transmitted to Planet Bliss's executive panel. In the end, Mr. Usher agreed to send 5 ships, which was more than adequate to transport all of Magnetite's stranded refugees. It took another 4 weeks for the rescue ships to arrive, and the floodwaters did begin to flow with more force, just as Emerson Raritan had predicted. But even in the face of the surging river, a handful of the Northerners refused to leave the new lives of luxury they'd begun in the southern sector. Charlie, Leah, their father, and Gwendolyn all bade regretful goodbyes to Uncle Luther at his estate. Then the 4 of them boarded the ship, which was to take them away, to Bliss. During the long flight from Magnetite to Bliss, they learned that the Raritan's estate's stolen ship had been intercepted in deep space, and that all of its passengers had been imprisoned. It's the end. Thank you, guys. And, so...
Interesting timing, and they just read the story by Nancy Press and Asimov that came out this latest issue.
Okay.
And it's about the opposite of that. It's about drought in the United States, a worldwide drought.
Okay.
The Great Lakes are a source of fresh water.
Okay.
And it's basically it's very similar style with, you know, kid against corporate America.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, no, I think that's something I'm a little bit proud of with this story, is that, you know, I feel like we were talking about this was coming into the conversation when this was published in David's magazine, but you know, now it's everywhere you look, and now people are a lot more aware of the great divide between, you know, the wealthiest and the rest of us.
Yeah.
And well, thank you guys very much for sitting through all that. It's about 6,000 words, so it's a smidge longer than a normal short story, but I appreciate you guys sitting through it.